As I walked in this morning, somebody handed me this. I just got to read it to you. It's just too good to not bless you with it. A kindergarten teacher gave her class a show-and-tell assignment. Each student was instructed to bring in an object to share with the class that represented their religion. The first student got up in front of the class and said, "My name is Benjamin, I'm Jewish, and this is the Star of David." The second student got up in front of the class and said, "My name is Mary, I'm a Catholic, and this is a rosary." The third student got up in front of the class and said, "My name is Nathan, I'm a Baptist, and this is a casserole." Every time in ministry, you run into something which is necessary to repeat. I remember the story about the old pastor who went visiting his flock, and as he stopped at this one house, he knocked on the door, but there wasn't any response. So he took one of his business cards out, and on the back of the business card, he wrote simply the reference to the verse Revelation 3:20, and slid it into the tiny area between the door and the doorstop, and walked on to the next home that he had to visit. And when Sunday came around, the offering plate, of course, was passed. And as he was in his office later, going through the offering plate and counting the offerings that were made, he noticed that someone had put his business card back into the offering plate. And this time had crossed out the reference to Revelation 3:20, and instead had written a reference to Genesis 3:10. And of course, you all know what what Revelation 3:20 states. It states the words of Jesus, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." And he had to look up what Genesis 3:10 said, and so he went to Genesis 3:10, and Genesis 3:10 said this: "I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid, for I was naked." So here's my question for you all this morning. When you experience moments of joy, when you experience moments of laughter, when you experience victories, when you experience triumphs, what is the first thought that comes to your mind, and how well do you handle, and how do you handle success? We're in Genesis chapter 14 this morning, and in this chapter there's a war story. So all of you who are war fans or war history fans, you will enjoy some of this, and those of you who aren't, just endure part of it with us. But in Genesis 14, remember how we left the story in Genesis 13. Abraham had said to his nephew Lot, "Look, buddy, let's not have any arguments between us. This entire land is spread out before us. You choose which area you like, and whichever area you like, I'm going to go to the other part. So if you choose the area over here, I'm going to go over there. If you choose the area over there, I'm going to go over here." And so remember, Lot chose the most luscious, the greenest valley. Remember, it was also the valley in which the city of Sodom happened to be. And we end the story of Genesis chapter 13 with Lot pitching his tent, you remember, toward Sodom. But what we're going to find out now as we enter into Genesis chapter 14, that's not the way things were left. Because remember, if you pitch your tent toward Sodom, you're eventually going to live in Sodom. If you pitch your tent toward Sodom, you're going to end up buying a penthouse in Sodom. So read with me parts of Genesis 14 as we try to pick up a little bit of the story here. At this time, Amraphael, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Kedolaomar, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, went to war with Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shem-Eber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these latter kings joined forces in the valley of Sidim, the Salt Sea. For 12 years they had been subject to Kedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, what's his name, and the kings allied with him, went out and defeated the Rephaites in, where's the, call it whatever you want, the Zuzites in Ham, the Emites in Shever, whatever, and the Horites in the hill country of Zer, as far as El Paran, near the desert. Then they turned back and went to En Mishpat, and they conquered the whole territory of the Amalekites as well as the Amorites who were living in Hazazon Tamar. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela marched out and drew up their battle lines in the valley of Sidim against Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, and a whole bunch of other kings. And what happened, notice, they end up seizing all the goods, verse 11, of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their food. Then they went away. So all those kings rebel against the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, and they end up joining forces, and they move their forces against Sodom and Gomorrah. They end up winning the battle, and then again, verse 11, the four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food. Then they went away. But notice verse 12. They also carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions, since he was living in Sodom. Notice, if you pinch your tent toward Sodom, you're going to end up living in Sodom. You'll buy a penthouse there eventually. So you don't go down any road part way, because if you start going down a road, you're probably going to continue down that path. And so just as we saw in Genesis chapter 13, what Lot begins ultimately culminates with his living within Sodom. And so when these rebel kings conquer Sodom and Gomorrah, they end up taking Lot and all of Lot's possessions along with them as part of their booty. And so there goes Abram's nephew off into captivity, and now the scene is set up for what is now going to happen in Genesis 14. So we're now in verse 13. One who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. Now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol and Anar, all of whom were allied with Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and all the other people. So notice, Abram takes 318 men, goes out against all of the rebel kings that had come and brought their forces together against Sodom and Gomorrah. With 318 guys, he rides against four or five kings with their armies. Now, these are kings, not of territories necessarily, but kings who hold reign over various city-states in the area. And he takes with 318 men who were not necessarily trained for battle and goes against these rebellious kings. And he wins the battle. He wins the battle to such a degree that he recovers all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah. And he brings back his relative Lot and his possessions together with the women and the other people who the kings that were in rebellion had taken captive from Sodom and Gomorrah. Notice, do you remember what he was called at the beginning of the paragraph in verse 13? One who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. In other words, this one singular Hebrew, this one man who had been selected by God and promised by God that he would receive huge inheritance of land that he had never seen before, went up against all these kings, whipped them, and took away all the bounty that they had taken from Sodom and Gomorrah. Now notice verse 17. After Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Sheveh, that is, the king's valley. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram. Now stop right there for a moment and get the scene. Right, these rebellious kings have ridden against Sodom and Gomorrah. They've conquered Sodom and Gomorrah. They've taken all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, and they've run away with them. Abram takes 318 guys, goes and whips the rebellious kings, takes all the goods they took from Sodom and Gomorrah, along with his nephew Lot, and comes back completely and utterly victorious. Man, Abram must be thinking, wow, I am really some hot dog. With 318 guys, I'm able to whip these kings and all their armies when the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah together couldn't. Look with me, if you will, at Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 27. Keep your finger there in Genesis, but come with me to Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 21. The book of Proverbs is right after the book of Psalms. If you fall right almost into the middle of the Bible, you're pretty near Psalms. And then just go one more book and you'll stumble into the book of Proverbs. Notice chapter 27 and verse 21. The crucible for silver and the furnace for gold. But man is tested by the praise he receives. The crucible for silver and the furnace for gold, but man is tested by the praise he receives. You test silver and you test gold in the fire, but people are tested when they receive praise, when they receive victory. And here's the question that Proverbs is asking. What kind of a person are you? What will your heart manifest when someone comes up to you and tells you, wow, I think you're great. Man, I think you're powerful. Wow, you and your men must be the most powerful army in the world. Notice what happened to Abram. He wipes out these rebellious kings, takes all their goods as well as everything they took from Sodom and Gomorrah, and when he comes back home, the king of Sodom rides out to him to give him thanks. The king of Sodom rides out to him to laud him and to praise him. And here's the question. What kind of man is Abram going to be in this moment of victory? In this moment of success, in this moment of triumph? Because moments of triumph and success, moments of moving from impoverishment to wealth, moments of getting a huge paycheck, moments of getting a reward, moments of getting recognition, These are the moments in which God is testing us in order to find out what is in our hearts, what is in our character. God tests us primarily in two key experiences. Experiences in which we are impoverished. When you're impoverished with financial lack, when you're impoverished with the loss of your job, when you're impoverished with grief, when you're impoverished with pain, when you're impoverished with discouragement, these are moments of testing. What is inside us? But the next moments in which God tests us are those moments in which we move from impoverishment to wealth, from lack to plenty, from defeat to victory, from sickness to health, from suffering to relief from suffering. And now it's the great moment of testing for Abram. So how do you respond when someone comes up and thanks you? How do you respond when someone comes up and pats you on the back and says, I really appreciate you? When someone comes up and says, I think you're great, I think you're beautiful, I think that you are, you're really special. How do you respond? Because that's a moment of testing in which we're all waiting to see what's inside. So back to Genesis chapter 14 and the story of Abram and the king of Sodom. Notice that just as the king of Sodom is riding up to him to give him all this laud and all of this honor, God sends an intervention. This other king rides up, right? Verse 18. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed Abram, saying, Blessed be Abram by God's Most High, Creator, or actually, the word that is used here is perhaps more accurately translated, not just merely creator, but possessor. Not the one who merely creates, but the one who possesses. The one who owns. Right? The one whose property is heaven and earth. So blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hands. Just in case, Abram, you didn't know. Just in case, Abram, you thought it was due to your military genius. Just in case, Abram, you thought it was due to the military strategic strength of these 318 men, just because, Abram, you might think that it was due to your great leadership, Abram, just because you might have confused this victory as your victory, I want you to know, as the priest of God Most High, that blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your When you are tested in those moments in which you are moved from poverty to wealth, from sadness to joy, from defeat to victory, do you recognize that as a child of God, as His son or as His daughter, that this is nothing more than a blessing that God Most High, who possesses all of heaven and earth, as in His grace and mercy provided for you. In the same way in which God Most High, who possesses heaven and earth, removes those things from you, He is the one who gives life and He is the one who brings defeat. Do you realize that the same one who gives is the same one who takes away, and the same one who takes away is the same one who gives, for He is the possessor of it all. And so when you receive victory, when you receive wealth, when you receive joy, when you receive relief from your defeat, whatever it might be, do you fall flat on your face in recognition that the God Most High, who possesses everything, is the one who has made this movement for me? It wasn't the 318 men. It wasn't Abram. It was God Most High. You see, Melchizedek may not ride into your life. Melchizedek physically may not ride into your life and set up a table of bread and of wine, blocking you from the king of Sodom. Because if Melchizedek hadn't ridden in and blocked Abram from meeting with the king of Sodom, here's what might have happened. You're right, king of Sodom. It was all me. I'm so great. I'm so strong. I'm so beautiful. Yep. You're right, it was all me. As a matter of fact, since it was all me, I want everything you have, or I'm going to do the same thing to you that I did to those bad boys over there. Yep. As a matter of fact, I think I'm going to start riding throughout the entire valley here. And I'm going to start doing to everybody else I can find what I just did to those five rebellious kings. Because if I did it once, I can do it again. You give me everything you have. As a matter of fact, give me everything you have now, and then I want you to start paying me 10% of everything you get in the future. Because I am now the new bad boy of the valley. And don't you mess with me, because I am good. You see, that's very possibly what could have happened. But God, in His mercy, sends Melchizedek, the king of Salem, in to intervene so that before Abram can meet with the king of Sodom, there is a sovereignly sent interruption in which Melchizedek sets out a table of bread and wine and says, Abram, just in case you forgot, I want to remind you that blessed are you by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed is the God who blessed you, because He's the one who delivered your enemies into your hand. Do you like to see your picture? Do you like to remember your conquests? Do you like to tell other people about your conquests? Do you like to make sure that everybody knows what you've been able to accomplish? If so, you are great to be pitied, because you didn't have the blessing of the intervention of Melchizedek. And you've been tested, and you failed the test. But you see, for every one of us, Melchizedek has ridden in, and Melchizedek has ridden in for us in the story of Genesis chapter 14. And so although Melchizedek hasn't ridden in physically and set up a table for us, you now know that whenever you go from poverty to wealth, whenever you go from suffering to pleasure, whenever you go from nothing to something, from defeat to victory, that it is a blessing that you have received, because God Most High, the one who possesses heaven and earth, has delivered this into your hand. So you now have no excuse. Because just like silver and gold are tested in the furnace, people are tested in victory. They're tested in wealth. They're tested in pleasure. So the story goes on. Then Abram gave him, that is Melchizedek, a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the people and keep the goods for yourself. You see, that's what he had come to tell Abram to begin with. Abram, look, I am so grateful for what you have done. You are such a mighty king. You are such a mighty general. You are just the cat's meow. Abram, you are just wonderful. Just let me have my people back, please. Just let me have my people back, and you can keep everything else, all the goods. All the goods that you took from those rebellious kings, all the goods that they had taken from Sodom, you can have them back. Just let me have my mom and my dad. Just let me have my sisters and my brothers. Just let me have my servants. And you can keep all the goods you want. That's how great you are, Abram. That's how frightened I am of you, Abram. You're the bad man of the valley. And you keep it all. As a matter of fact, Abram, I'm bowing down before you. And I'm just asking you to let me keep my people. Everything else is yours. But Abram, having heard from Melchizedek, but Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord, God Most High. And notice he now uses the language that Melchizedek had given him. I have raised my hand to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or a thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, I made Abram rich. I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me to Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them have their share. But I will accept nothing. Why? Because Abram from Melchizedek had learned that it was God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, who from his possessions, for the heaven is his and the earth is his and all that fill them are his, from his possessions, which are the earth and heaven and all that fill them, from the God Most High's possession, he delivered the kings and their goods into Abram's hand. And so Abram had been made rich by God. And he would receive nothing from the king of Sodom, because that would have been to assume, and that would have been to testify to the world that the king of Sodom was the one who had benefited him. But Abram had heard from the priest of the Most High God, Melchizedek, and he had learned that it was God Most High, the one who possesses heaven and earth, who had given him this victory, who had given him this wealth. As a matter of fact, come back with me just two chapters earlier to Genesis chapter 12. So Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1. The Lord had said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. And whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Did you see the pronoun? Did you see the pronoun that occurs time and time again? I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. And so, Abram, never, ever confuse yourself with me. Never confuse your talent with me. Never confuse your strategic ability and your negotiation techniques with me. Never confuse your good looks and never confuse your ability to schmooze with me. Never confuse anything which you think you have which has given you success with me, Abram, for I am the God Most High. And I am the one who possesses heaven and earth. And I distribute my possessions to whom I want, when I please, as I choose. And in this case, Abram, I have chosen to bless you. But don't ever look in the mirror and say, I just did it again. Because you are not the possessor of heaven and of earth. You benefit from the possessor, but you don't possess. And so we see from this story that time and time again in the book of Genesis, God is having to remind Abram of the true source of his blessing. Of the one who is behind everything that happens to him. Remember that this language goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Abram's God, who is blessing him, is the God who created and the God who possesses all that is in heaven and all that is in earth. Melchizedek occurs again in the Bible, you'll recall. He occurs again in the New Testament. As a matter of fact, he occurs again in the Psalms, but is in Hebrews chapter 7. Where we encounter Melchizedek once again as the author of the letter to the Hebrews talks to us about Jesus Christ and about the identity of Jesus Christ. And so in Hebrews chapter 7, notice what we are told about Melchizedek and about Christ. Notice verse 11. If perfection could have been attained through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it the law was given to the people, why was there still need for another priest to come? One in the order of Melchizedek, not in the order of Aaron. For when there is a change of the priesthood, there must also be a change of the law. He of whom these things are said belonged to a different tribe, and no one from that tribe has ever served on the altar. For it is clear that our Lord descended from Judah, and in regard to that tribe Moses said nothing about priests. And what we have said is even more clear if another priest like Melchizedek appears, one who has become a priest not on the basis of a regulation as to his ancestry, but on the basis of the power of an indestructible life, for it is declared, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. What the author to the Hebrews is saying here is that you need to understand that when Israel was organized by God, there was a particular family line that was to produce the priests of Israel. It was the family line of the Levites, and we know this as the Levitical priesthood. This family line was to be the line from which all the priests of Israel came forth. And so if you weren't in the line of Levites, you did not serve in the temple of God. You did not serve to make the sacrifices and to provide atonement for Israel. And yet, we find that Jesus Christ is not of the line of Levite. Jesus Christ is not related to the Levites at all. Jesus Christ is outside that line continually and completely. And yet what the seventh chapter of Hebrews is telling us is that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is also a priest forever, but not in the line of the Levites, not in the line of the Levitical priesthood. Jesus Christ is a priest, yes, but he is a priest after the line of Melchizedek. This king who in Genesis chapter 14 comes out of nowhere, sets up a table of wine and of bread for Abraham, blocking Abraham's access to the king of Sodom so that he might give to Abram the recognition about who it was who accomplished this thing for him. Melchizedek comes out of nowhere. We've never heard of him before in Genesis. He just appears out of nowhere, this king of Salem, this priest of the Most High. He sets up this table. He goes in, and we never hear about him again. And yet now we find out in the book of Hebrews that the Lord Jesus Christ is a priest, but he is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. He is a descendant from Melchizedek's priesthood, not a descendant from the line of Levite. And so what Hebrews is going to tell us is that the Levitical priesthood was good. It served its purpose. It accomplished the sacrifices that provided this temporary atonement for the sins of Israel, but it wasn't ever intended and it wasn't ever good enough to accomplish the type of atonement that would last forever. So notice how the story continues in Hebrews chapter 7 and now verse 18. The former regulation is set aside because it was weak and useless, for the law made nothing perfect, and a better hope is introduced by which we draw near to God. And it was not without any oath. Others became priests without any oath, but he became a priest with an oath when God said to him, "The Lord has sworn, you will not change my mind, you are a priest forever." Because of this, Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. Now there were many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing in office, but because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. What Hebrews chapter 7 is telling us is that if you attempted to live by the old covenant, if you attempted to live by the law, and if you thought that your attempts to keep the law to please God would eventually bring you enough blessings where you could earn your own way and your own recognition before God so that God would bless you and make you prosperous because of what you had done, Hebrews chapter 7 has just told you that that was never going to work, because the old covenant was weak. As a matter of fact, it uses the word useless. The old covenant could never, ever bring you the blessings which you so desperately needed. Now, you could fool yourself into thinking that your great talent in this area had brought you this blessing, or your great attempts to keep the law in this area had been rewarded by God with this kind of blessing, or that your refusal to enter into that kind of lifestyle was the reason why God had rewarded you with all of this, but you would have just been fooling yourself. You would have just been standing up and going, "Yep, I'm the bad boy of the valley." What we are being told in Hebrews chapter 7 is that all of us needed a priest. A priest who would live forever and who would accomplish for us that which we were unable to accomplish for ourselves, and that which any human priesthood was unable to accomplish for us. The lesson of Hebrews chapter 7 is exactly the lesson of Hebrews of Genesis chapter 14. You are never the one who earns your blessings. You are never the ones who merit God's kindness to you. You are never the ones who are strategic enough, mighty enough, smart enough, good-looking enough, articulate enough to gain anything you have received. You are always the ones to whom the God Most High, who is the possessor of heaven and of earth, and who has provided a priest of the line of Melchizedek who lives forever, you are always the one who has received, because the possessor of heaven and earth has been gracious, merciful, kind, generous, and compassionate to you through the priest who lives forever, Jesus of Nazareth. How will you stand up to the next test? As gold and silver are tested in fire, how will you stand up to your next victory? How will you manifest your character in the next compliment that comes your way? How will you manifest what you are when you next move from defeat to victory? Your reply should be along these lines. I am merely the one who has been gifted. I'm merely the one who has been blessed. I'm nothing more than the one who has received from the generosity, from the kindness, from the mercy of God Most High, who is the possessor of heaven and earth. So what kind of places do we find ourselves in when the temptation not to listen to the intervention of a Melchizedek is the strongest? And what are some ways that you found it helpful in your own language to reflect your recognition that behind everything you have is nothing more than a merciful God? Help us out here. How have you been an Abram before a king of Sodom?
When the praise of man is allowed, would we have a problem if we didn't have sin nature? I think that's the question that comes to mind.
Yeah. So what do we do when the praise of men is the loudest? The praise of men comes in all shapes. How does the praise of men come? It comes vocally. Boy, you're great. How else does the praise of men come? Yes. Rewards. Yeah. Raises. Success. Recognition. Popularity. How else?
Admiration.
Yeah. How else? Popularity. So, if we're going to be Abrams before the king of Sodom, How do we live out a life of being Abrams before the king of Sodom? What does that life look like?
When the king of Sodom comes, you are already ready.
That's very helpful. Yeah, be prepared. Excellent. Remember that Abram doesn't have a track record here that is necessarily good, right? Remember how well he did in Egypt? Remember how well he did in the famine? And so Abraham doesn't have the wonderful track record here. And so let's be prepared for these situations. Yes. Haven't happened to. Yeah, absolutely. Which is why sometimes it's really helpful for us to think, when we want to say that God has blessed us, it's really helpful for us to say, maybe he's testing us. And to see the blessing as a test. What are you going to do with it? And the same question arises in Genesis chapter 12. We have no idea why God selects Abram out of every human being on the face of the earth. He comes from a pagan family. His dad was worshiping idols. He was taught to worship idols. And out of all these idolaters, God chooses Abram and says, Abram, I'm going to give you everything. Abram didn't do anything to do. He just chooses him. I think sometimes it's very helpful for us to say, wow, I have all this. All right, God's testing me to see what I'm going to do with it. Such a good question, you do. I think that's right. That could be. But he does choose a pagan, right? And the first time we see Abram, we're wondering why in the world did God choose this pagan? I think one way of looking at it is that God sees into the future and sees what Abram will do. But I think another perhaps way of looking at it is that God saw Abram and saw what Abram couldn't do, and so decided to do for Abram what Abram couldn't do for himself, just out of grace and out of mercy. But Abram doesn't win God's favor. God, just in his generosity, gives Abram favor. I think that's exactly why he does it. Yeah. I think that's exactly right, because in my heart I'm a pagan. And the only way that I can move from being a pagan to being a believer is if God in his mercy chooses to be gracious and kind to me. Let me close with some prayer. So, Father, you are the Father of lights, the giver of every good gift, as James tells us. You are the one who possesses heaven and earth, and you dole out these gifts as you see fit. Strengthen us by the Spirit to remember and to be aware that we have received every spiritual blessing only through Christ, and that all that we have received from no one other than you, and that you are the Father who takes care of your children. I pray that you would find us strong in the times of testing. I pray that you would comfort those who are mourning. I pray that you would strengthen those who are weak. I ask that you would be gracious to those who weep. I ask it through the Son and by the Spirit. Amen.